First thing, we're going to change the agenda. We're going to have Association Oregon Counties and then the League of Oregon Cities. So, counties, come on up. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Gilman and members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And with me here today is Judge Laura Pryor from Gillum County. She's the chair of our Transportation Steering Committee. And also Bill Penhollow, who is also with the Association of Oregon Counties and has a wealth of experience when it comes to this. Actually, I will say that Judge Pryor and Mr. Penhollow have a wealth of experience when it comes to transportation and working with the legislature over the last 20 years or more. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Judge Pryor.
Thank you, Art. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be back here again on transportation. We have a PowerPoint presentation for you. You may like to just keep it for later. There's good information in it. This is our opportunity to take a few minutes and try to give you a picture of Oregon's counties and our road system. I think the most important thing for us right out of the box is that it's an interconnected system. When folks are out there driving around on the streets and the roads and the highways, they don't really pay much attention to whether it belongs to the counties, the cities, or ODOT. They want it to work. That's what's important for them. The interconnected system represents 36 counties, and there's 118 elected county officials that are responsible for our part of the system, judges and county commissioners. We all have very good engineers and roadmasters that are professionals to take care of our part of the system, no matter where we live in the state. Oregon's counties provide many services, and most of all that's important is we get industry moving. It moves over all the system, but it moves over the county road system. In my county, we move about 5 to 7 million bushels of wheat a year out of fields onto the county roads and then down to the river to get it to Portland and then outbound to international trade. And that's true no matter what the industry is, no matter where you are in the state of Oregon, it travels over that system. The governing bodies of the counties have authority over the system, and we have the legal ability to sign contracts for millions of dollars of road work, which we do every year. We all serve the same 3.5 million Oregonians and industries in the state of Oregon, whether you're on the coast, whether you're clear over on the Boise border, whether you're on the Columbia River or you're down on the Nevada-California border. We still cover the same 97,000 miles. Counties employ over 18,000 Oregonians, and in many of the rural counties, we are the largest employer in the county. The diversity of Oregon's counties requires a very flexible approach to statewide policy making because one size doesn't fit all. Every time you see me, you're going to see this next slide. And that is because I come from the second smallest county in the state. There's 1,900 people in my county, and many of you have apartment houses or complexes that are that big where you live. The next map shows the critical problem facing you, the governor, and the cities and the counties is how do you fashion systems, major systems, in this case transportation system, that goes from counties that have over 500,000 people down to counties that have 1,500 people. Inherent in that question, that one question, is a range of issues. In my county, we've got 490 miles of road, 90 of it's paved. So when I'm here talking to you, I'm not talking to you about speed bumps and curbs and street lights and sidewalks. I'm talking about needing to be able to crush enough rock to be able to keep it on the road so that we can get the grain out of the fields and get it to market. So it's quite different than the needs in Beaverton, where there's tremendous congestion issues. So the needs are extraordinary across the state, and they're driven by mostly that one issue. How do you do that? And this is our challenge. So I'm going to ask you to consider six counties as an example: Multnomah, Lincoln, Lane, Wheeler, Harney, and Jackson. You can see what the population is. The population of Multnomah County is over 500,000. And then it drops down to Wheeler County, which is just south of my county, 1,500 people. When you look at the square miles, it changes significantly. Harney County, with 10,000, is larger than Massachusetts. So I'm going to ask you to please remember this slide. Although we're talking about transportation now, I'm going to ask you to please remember this, because this is significant to all of the issues that face us and face you and all of the things that are going to be before you for the next 6 months. The road miles tell a little bit different story. Lane County has the largest number of road miles. So you can see quickly what the diversity is across the state. The next slide is the interconnected state-county services. And in this case, we're talking about transportation. But in many of the major systems, whether you're talking about medicine, whether you're talking about law enforcement, the courts, whether you're talking about education, whatever you're talking about, we have interconnected systems. And anywhere, it's like hydraulics. If you tweak over here, it's going to pop out over there. So all of us wrestle with this. All of us on both sides of this table that are elected and have jurisdictional responsibility wrestle with this. Oregon's seamless road system means that the counties manage a portion of that. But I'm going to ask you to consider this. The only place that it's seamless is on the ground where people are out there driving around in their vehicles. The minute you begin to get away from that, the minute you get to, we start talking about policy decisions or management decisions, it begins to become compartmentalized with the jurisdiction that has responsibility. So just by that fact alone, you're starting a dynamic. And that dynamic has consequences. Oregon's highway and road system is broken up. It's 44,400 miles. There's 8,100 miles, which is the state system, and in many cases, it's the most expensive system, part of the system to maintain. There's 27,000 miles of county road, 9,300 miles of city streets. Most people think that all the roads and streets and highways in the county, in the state, are paved. They are not. I've already mentioned before our problem with that. There's 16,000 miles are paved of county roads, and there's 11,000 that are unpaved. Western Oregon has 80% paved. Eastern Oregon has 40% paved. So this first part of our presentation, we're going to break this up in three pieces so we don't bore you to death, I hope. This part of the presentation, I hope, sets the stage for some of the discussions that you're going to be having in the next few months. And with that, I'm going to ask Art Slack to quickly go through a little bit more specifics.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you look at the county's 27,000 miles, it is broken into a classification system of arterials, collectors, and local streets. And with this slide, you can see that the arterials are the principal routes used to connect population centers and to provide for commerce. These are many times looked at freight routes. Collectors are do just what it says, that collects the traffic from the local routes and feeds those to the collectors and also to the state highway system. And we have, as you can see, 15,000 miles of local road that provide access to individual properties and in some cases to commercial and industrial development. In addition to the county road system that you see there, those 27,000 miles, there's approximately 6,600 road miles of local access roads. These are roads that are deeded to the county for public use, but they're not part of the county road system. So the easiest way of looking at that is that these roads are primarily, you'll find, as graveled or unimproved roads, and they're only maintained or worked on in the case of emergency situations at this point, but they do provide access to remote areas and to industrial forest uses, as well as some rural residential and farm uses. In addition to the road miles that counties have, we have a system of bridges and culverts, which is quite large. We have 3,400 bridges that are in excess of 20 feet in length, and approximately 600 bridges that are less than 20 feet in length, and approximately 126,000 culverts that have to be maintained and sometimes improved and replaced to deal with fist passage and other water quality kinds of issues. Bill?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name's Bill Penhollow with the Association of Oregon Counties. And what I would like to do is to take my part and kind of walk you through the financing of all this. How do we budget for these county roads, these 27,000 miles of county roads? The first slide that is before you is a pie chart that represents the basic revenue sources of funds to the counties for their road systems. Half of it comes from the state, basically the highway fund, which is made up of gas tax, weight mile tax, and other fees that are charged at the state level and shared with the cities and the counties. 27% comes from federal sources. Some of these are federal grants, but I'll talk about the major source of federal funds here in a moment. And then local funds are imposed by the counties. We have two counties that have local gas taxes. We have counties that have property taxes for road purposes. We have counties that impose systems development charges and other fees for the purposes of maintaining their road system. And in every case, these funds are dedicated to roads and are not really fungible funds that can be diverted to the general fund. I want to take a moment to talk about the federal funds, because this counties have a major concern facing them with regard to our federal funds. And an issue that's not only a concern to counties, but as you look at the magnitude of this issue facing counties, you will see that it has potentially an impact statewide on the state, counties, and cities. There is a program which we simply call the Safety Net, Federal Forest Safety Net Program, which was passed by Congress. And the reason for this is, as the timber harvest on federal lands started to decline in the 80s, and counties saw that the revenues were going away, we were faced with a major dilemma on how to finance our system when you recognize that almost a quarter of that comes from these resources. Historically, the Forest Service had shared 25% of their harvest revenues off of the federal forest lands with the counties. The counties received the funds by statute, 75% went to the road funds, 25% went to the county school fund, which is a part of the funding for education. This revenue sharing agreement was established because of the federal land, the domination of federal lands in our counties across the state, and had reduced the tax base that the counties had available to them. Now, this has been in place for a century, and it was only when we were faced with the decline of harvest. It started principally with the issue of the spotted owl in western Oregon, but then other environmental issues that resulted in a decline of those revenues. We talk about federal lands. As I think most of you know, 54% of Oregon is made up of federal and state lands. Going on, as these revenues began to decline through the 90s, the counties were faced with a major financial concern on how to continue to maintain those funds. As we were talking, give you an idea of the magnitude. Those revenues, the 75% that was allocated to roads in the early 90s had approached about $100 million. So there's about $100 million from those funds going to the county road fund for road maintenance modernization purposes. Through the 90s, we saw that declining significantly. Some counties lost as much as 90-95% of those revenues over that 10-year period. And so Oregon, along with other states across the nation, went to Congress, and in 2000 were successful in getting Congress to pass the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000. And that provided a federal, if you will, general fund appropriation to the counties across the nation for a period of 6 years. This act is now scheduled to be reauthorized in 2006, or, you know, we face the results of losing those revenues. We have already started working with our National Association of Counties and our county partners across the nation in asking Congress to reauthorize those revenues. But as you know, the federal budget situation of 2005 is significantly different than it was in the year 2000 when we got this measure passed. So we are competing with the federal budget deficit, the issue over the deficit. We are competing with, if you will, dollars that are needed for the war effort in Iraq and other federal programs. We're optimistic about getting Congress to reauthorize this, but I think you see our dilemma in asking Congress to reauthorize this program for another 6 years, or even we would prefer on a permanent basis to replace those revenues that we lost as a result of the decline in federal forest harvest. The slide before you now gives you an indication of how significant this is to Oregon. As I indicated, we receive about $100 million a year from the safety net program, the federal program. If we were to immediately, if the measure was not reauthorized and we were to fall back on timber harvest shared revenues, you'll see that our revenues would drop from about $100 million back to about $5 million a year. A $95 million hole in road financing for the state of Oregon. I want to talk just a moment about, leave you with this slide on where our monies go, county road fund expenditures. A large part, 31%, goes into construction and expansion of the system. This is modernization for the most part. dealing with the congestion that we find in some of the areas that are have rapid growth. We are making a big investment, the majority of the funding going into what we call preservation and maintenance. And then you'll note the other items there on the pie chart of lesser significance. What I would like to do at this time, Mr. Chair, is to turn the microphone back to Judge Pryor and have her kind of bring this all together for a summation for you, if you please. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I see we're running over, so I'm just going to go to the last slide. Just some of the key points, the key point that I'd like to make here is you have the presentation, you can look at the other things we're going to say, but one of the most important things that we believe is there's probably not a willingness to have a gas tax again. It's been 14 years, well, 15 years. We probably won't get one, so by the time you're all back here again, it'll be 16 years. So there's a major funding problem facing Oregon and its streets, the city streets, county roads, and its state highways. You're going to have a multimodal bill before you. The industry has to move. Freight moves our industry one way or another, whether it's by air, by water, or on land. But the backbone of that whole system is your street, road, and highway system. So what we are hoping will come out of this session is a dialogue and a discussion towards trying to figure out how together the cities, the counties, and the state figure out how to run the system, because right now we're very disconnected in our jurisdictional responsibility. But one thing we all need is a way to at least preserve and protect what we've got and keep it functioning. And with that, Mr. Chairman, we'd be glad to take any questions.
Questions for counties. Wonderful
We're
presentation. Thanks,
Thank
Bill
you. Arson. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're ready for cities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. And while we're getting this set up, just hit enter. I just want to introduce today Hillsborough Mayor Tom Hughes. Tom is on our board of directors and also chairs our Transportation Policy Committee, and he'll be making our presentation today.
Thank you, Willie. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think I'm going to walk through some of these slides. We're passing out now the PowerPoint that we're going to make today, and in the interest of time, I think I'll go through some of the mission of the League of Oregon Cities. And just to point out, we're founded in 1925. We've been around for about 80 years now, so we're not Johnny Come Latelys. The point I think under strong cities make a strong state. We really are the engine of economic growth and development. My city, for example, we were told last year by the Department of Revenue that of the $9 billion in the state of Oregon that's assessed for high tech, about $6 billion of it is in the city limits of Hillsborough. So some of us play really key roles in terms of the economic engine that drives the state, particularly in terms of the knowledge-based industries. About 2.3 million of that 3.4 million Oregonians we were talking about have chosen to live and work in cities. We are all of the cities in the state of Oregon operate under a charter, so we have our own kind of our own set of rules, our own government, and the voters. It means that we've been created consciously by the residents of our community, and in In fact, in the last election, the residents of the Damascus area chose to create the 241st city in the state of Oregon by creating the city of Damascus. And so we are conscious creations of the citizens that we serve. And I think just as the state of Oregon is, that's an important thing to understand. I'm sure you're probably aware of the fact that the city is a provider of most of the essential services that I think we come to equate with both economic prosperity and with civilization in many regards. And so we'll kind of go over that. And I would sort of begin a little bit where Judge Pryor left off, and that is that we are collectively we are owners of the system, and collectively the cities and the counties have stewardship over maintaining what we hope is a seamless system. And I would I would emphasize in our particular case, cities basically provide the last mile of that system, and I think that's the important part that we make. The mile that gets Intel's product from their plant in Hillsboro to the airport, that first mile to get on the state highway system is on a Hillsboro city street, and the materials that come to their plant to manufacture that, the last mile are on city streets. And so while in some respects we don't have the kind of mileage that the counties do, for example, ours is a very important element of that. As I said before, there are 241 cities in the state. Have I gotten ahead? Yep. Actually, it says 240 because we haven't updated since Damascus came in. And as of 2000, we had 9,315 miles of street. We suspect that it's considerably more than that because that grew about 1,500 miles from 1990 to 2000, and so we're 5 years into the thing. We would anticipate about another 750, so we're right at 10,000 miles in our system. 8,629 of that are paved. As you see, in distinction from the county, we have relatively few unpaved roads within city limits. One of the reasons why ours is growing dramatically is that the population within the cities in Oregon is growing dramatically, and as new suburbs or new subdivisions are created, they create new city streets, which then we have to maintain. So from 1990 to 2000, Oregon's population increased by over 20%. If you happen to be living in the city of Hillsboro in 1990, there were about 37,000 people. Today there's about 80,000 people. So we've just about doubled in population during that 10-year period of time. But overall for the state, the increase for city population, for the population of the state in general, was about 20%. And as you can see from this graph, the bulk of that growth in population took place within cities. We also have this particular graph talks about the difference between the amount of miles 10 years ago and the amount from 89 to 99. You notice state highways were pretty flat. We think that probably grew by 6 miles. We're not sure where those 6 miles were, but they're out there somewhere. We think what actually that means is there's been particularly since the three OTIA bills passed, there's been a pretty dramatic push from the state part for cities to transfer jurisdiction over the streets where a state highway is a main street, for example, in a town. There's been some pressure on OTIA, on the part of the ODOT, to transfer the maintenance of that street over to the cities as part of the OTIA funding program. And so we think that you may see an increase and a decrease that's pretty net flat. There's been a slight decrease in county roads and as I said before, about a 1,600 mile increase in city streets. By their nature, just as a quick distinction between county roads and city streets, by their nature, city streets are more complex. A street, and there's a great deal of difference between a street and a road, in that quite often in the county, roads do not include curbs, sidewalks, storm sewers, gutters, bike paths, and some of the other things that we usually include in city streets. We also are more likely to have utilities in the right-of-way, sewer, water, electric and telephone right-of-ways. And so our streets are probably the most complex part of the system. That last mile becomes very complex. Also, a number of factors that are increasing, that are contributing to the increase in cost. Our system is aging, increased cost and depleting purchasing power of the dollar, increased use of the system driven by the population growth, and one of the things that has created a tremendous increase for us in the last 5 to 10 years has been the dramatic increase in cost, particularly the cost of steel and aggregate has driven the cost of road construction up significantly. It's an interesting graph, if it's the right one. Yep. Basically, what we're trying to show here is that the cost of maintaining a mile of road increases dramatically over the number of years that you avoid the maintenance. So deferred maintenance winds up being much more expensive to the taxpayer than regular maintenance on a fairly adequate basis. So let me go just real quickly over the financial picture for cities. Again, in what we have here at the level one under current services is a projection in each of the biennium of the gap between projected needs, and these numbers, by the way, are from the revenue and legislative revenue, and so we think that they're very conservative numbers. For example, in 2001-2003, we show a $112 million gap, and we have reason to believe that that gap was actually about $130 million. But these are the most reliable figures that we have available, and as you can see, each year the gap not only increases, but it increases at a faster rate than it was increasing before. So our cost of maintaining the roads, and the other thing that I would point to is that this includes the money that was provided for local maintenance through the OTIA programs. And so even with the OTIA money that we got in the last session of the legislature, we still showed $130 million gap between need and ability, and we're projecting that need in 2005-2007 conservatively at $150 million, even with the OTIA money that's already in the pipe. One of our favorite pie charts about the revenues for city streets, 54% comes from local property tax, where cities have gas tax. We'll show you a chart in a second that shows the different sources. And then state and, of course, the feds contribute the least of all in terms of city streets. So what are those local revenues? Property tax is about 13%. In my county, we have a MISTIP program, so the citizens of Washington County have in the last 10 years put about $225 million of our local property tax money back into the transportation system. And quite frankly, that has kept us above, kind of kept our nose just at the water level in terms of being able to keep up with the growth that we've seen up there. There are some local gas taxes. We have interest income. Development fees, what we charge the developer, is a big chunk. And bonds and note proceeds, and then other local revenues. And that's about 37%, and that runs the gamut of a variety of different sources of revenue. Expenditures, and again, over half of our expenditures are on maintenance and preservation. 44% on maintenance, 7% on preservation. Only about a quarter of the money that we're spending collectively at the city level is on construction and expansion, and that includes construction and expansion in new subdivisions, which is, you know, as we've already said, is pretty much covered by the development fees. I also noticed, I think, a slightly smaller percentage of bike path money than with the counties, which is beginning to be a problem, particularly in the urban areas where we would like to create alternative sources of transportation. So what are we doing to solve the financial problem at the local level? Over half the revenues available for city streets comes from local revenues, and there's a list there of what we use. Levies, traffic impact fees, permits, street utility fees, parking fees, and it goes on and on and on. One of the things that I would point out is that there are several of these major sources on our list that have in the last couple sessions of the legislature been challenged by legislation that would preempt our ability to collect them. And so always keep in mind that to the degree that you preempt our ability to raise money locally, you then make that gap that we were talking about substantially larger, particularly if you're not providing replacement money from the state level. So I would kind of underscore that. We've also tried a tremendous number of, and with 241 cities, it probably varies from city to city. We have tried privatization to lower costs. Again, in Hillsborough, which is the one city that I'm most familiar with, we recently did a state highway project that where we pulled, in addition to city funds, we pulled Intel money into the mix so that we could expand the ability to improve an intersection that, quite frankly, helped to serve the workers at the Intel plant, although it also was a major street in the community. So I think we've all tried those sorts of efforts to become more efficient. A number of ways that we've tried to get more efficient in terms of joint purchasing and other kinds of things that help write down the costs. But the impact of the maintenance, and just have some comments there from folks who in various cities who will talk to you a little bit about the impact of the maintenance shortfall. But what it means is increasingly we're having difficulty with simple maintenance of the system as it exists now. We're not really talking about much in the way of growth, but really the maintenance portion of it has begun to become very crucial for us in terms of maintaining the system. We have in the urban areas, in the Portland metropolitan area, probably a bigger problem in terms of trying to increase capacity, but we're trying to increase capacity at the same time as we're trying to maintain the quality of the streets that are there already. And major streets such as Front Street in Portland and Center Street, is it in Salem, that are already beginning to deteriorate because of the lack of the ability of the local governments to perform adequate maintenance on them. With that, I will go into the sunset and see if there's any questions I can answer.
I have a comment more than a question,
okay.
Mr. Mayor. In your efficiencies, you have cities partner with local and state government for increased efficiency.
Right.
In Jackson County, the county road department and state road department have common facilities. They have the same maintenance facility. It's all on the same piece of ground. I really think that that's a good way for cities, too, to become involved in that kind of a partnership. You may not have to buy a piece of equipment. You may be able to borrow it from the
right.
county or the state.
Well, and I know that we engage in those kinds of efficiencies between Hillsborough and Washington County in terms of use of equipment, use of crews, depending on who has a larger crew or a smaller crew, so that we don't you don't lose capacity in one agency while another agency needs them. We'll sometimes contract out with the others for that kind of efficiency also. But I think you're right, Mr. Chairman.
And it has another good spin-off that Judge Pryor mentioned, that we need to work together. If you're kind of co-housed, you talk to each other a little more.
That's absolutely, yes, sir. That's absolutely correct.
Well, that concludes our testimony. We'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here today. I'm wondering, Mayor, if you might have some thoughts, either today or to get back to us at some point in the future, about one of the, at least what I view as one of the fundamental inequities in the system, which relates to, obviously, for every dollar we invest, either in through gas taxes or weight mile taxes or vehicle reg fees or title transfer fees, whatever the source, all Oregonians get the benefit of that 50% that goes to the state. all Oregonians get the benefit of that 30% that goes to counties because we all have county roads. But for districts like mine that are 80% unincorporated, there's no benefit of any of that 20% that we all pay, 20 cents of every dollar that my constituents and I pay. None of that goes into serve anything in unincorporated areas. And so we have this long-standing, from my perspective, inequity in the system. I wonder if you have any thoughts about,
Mr. Chairman,
biennium or in future biennium, how we might address that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt, I'm a little vague in terms of the monies, the 20% being the money that is shared by the state with the cities.
Right. How about
that? It's actually 16%, but I think the point, the fairness of the equity in that comes in to a certain extent in that it's distributed on a per capita basis, and so the money comes back, and understanding that in terms of general population, in my county where 50% of the people live in unincorporated areas, and that's about 200,000 people, they also are not receiving the money that is shared back by the state to the cities. But again, the cities then bear the burden, a larger burden within the city limits of maintaining the city streets. And Willie's been working on this a little bit longer than I have, so perhaps has some wisdom on that also. But.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt. I think the point is that we're trying to make, and I think the county's made the point as well, is that it is a system. It's a systems approach. How we fund that system is critical. The jobs that many Oregonians go to are in cities, and even though those folks may live in unincorporated areas, they need to use city streets to get there. Goods and services that come into this state, although largely come through the interstate system, very, very important for city governments to have a well-functioning interstate system, although the state is the primary owners. It's also important that we have a well-funded distribution system in the city so we can get those goods to market for other folks. So I think the point is that just because a city resident lives in a city, it's important that the county roads are funded adequately and the state roads are funded adequately as well as the city roads so that the whole system and the economy can work together in a seamless way.
Thank you. And in terms of roadways that are moving freight, I would agree with you completely. Whether those are happen to be city, county, or state roads, I agree with you completely in terms of the critical nature of those. My problem comes, and I would encourage you to come out to my district, where you've got cities bordering it that have well-paved streets by and large, with curbs and gutters by and large, and you've got unincorporated areas equally urbanized that have neither. And so you've got all of us paying the same amount of gas taxes, same amount of vehicle reg fees, same amount of title transfer fees, same weight mile tax, and yet those that happen to live in a city equally densely populated have far better transportation services than those right next door. And you can see it on some roads where you leave the city into the unincorporated area. Same neighborhood, same size houses, same school district even, and yet far less transportation services because of this inequity in the system. So I, more than anything, I guess I'd encourage you to think about that and come back to us in the future with ways that we can address that, because there is and it's not an issue related to the freight mobility routes. It's really an issue related to local residential streets that happen to be in cities or happen to be in unincorporated areas.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt, I guess I would add one caveat before I leave also, that I'm not certain that that's universal around the state. And in for example, and again in Washington County, quite often the streets in Washington County are as well maintained as the ones within the cities. So I'm not sure how that money gets distributed differently in our county than it does in your county. But I guess I would say that I don't know that that's a that inequity shows itself that dramatically equally throughout the state. But I could be wrong.
Other questions?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
City of Portland. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susan Schneider, lobbyist for the City of Portland. With me is Matt Williams, who's the director of the Department of Transportation. And we don't have a PowerPoint presentation for you, but we do have some brief comments for you. So Brant, we'll go ahead.
Okay, Chair Gilman and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to speak to you about local transportation funding in Oregon. Again, for the record, my name is Brant Williams. I'm the director of the City of Portland Office of Transportation. I'd like to address with you three things this afternoon. First, OTIA 3, the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. Second, how Portland spends the money that you send to the City of Portland. And third, the problem that the city faces with respect to transportation funding. First and foremost, I want to thank you for passing OTIA 3 legislation at your last session. OTIA 3 is the first significant increase in ongoing transportation funding for local jurisdictions in over a decade. We know that when you passed the bill, you intended for the discretionary funds for local jurisdictions to go primarily for maintenance. I am pleased to say that the City of Portland has met this obligation. OTIA 3 funds allowed us to replenish fundamental services such as street paving, traffic signal maintenance, bridge replacements, and roadside maintenance, all services that have unfortunately been reduced over the years due to insufficient funds. Again, thank you for this important assistance. Second, let me describe for you how we spend the Highway Trust Fund money. Approximately two-thirds of the funds the City of Portland receives each year are spent on maintenance. These funds go towards street paving, striping, street cleaning, sign maintenance, traffic signal repair, and so on. The other one-third is spent on system operations and development. This includes things such as traffic engineering, congestion management, traffic signal electrical power, and rebuilding streets. Since the last increase in the gas tax over 10 years ago, transportation maintenance funds have become increasingly tight. To make the money stretch as far as possible, Portland has implemented a number of efficiencies, including recycling asphalt, concrete, and rock, recycling leaves into valuable compost, recycling street sweeping debris, ensuring the street pavement is done at competitive rates, using the most cost-effective pavement marking material, and substantially reducing electricity costs by using the most efficient traffic signal devices. The city has developed comprehensive asset management plans to minimize the long-term maintenance and operation costs. We've also taken steps along with ODOT and TriMet to maximize the use of our existing roadways in order to minimize the additional costs associated with widening and or building new freeways and major streets in the Portland area. Given these examples, I want to assure you that we are doing what we can to provide citizens with the most for their Highway Trust Fund tax dollars. Finally, I want to speak to you on the funding problem that faces the City of Portland. The value of Portland's transportation infrastructure is approximately $6.4 billion. This includes over 2,000 miles of streets, 1,000 traffic signals, 140,000 traffic signs, and 175 bridges. In order to avoid creating long-term liabilities for future generations, it's essential that we provide adequate funding today to reasonably maintain and protect this public investment in our transportation system. The new OTIA 3 funds, along with the ongoing efficiencies that I just talked about, provide only a partial solution to our long-term transportation funding problem. Funding shortfalls still need to be addressed. The City of Portland is currently losing ground in our ability to maintain and preserve our system. We have an increasing funding shortfall in our operating budget over the next 5 years of approximately $18 million. In fact, in order to maintain our assets at a sustainable level, and by this I mean keep them reasonably in good condition without further deterioration, we would actually need another $25 to $28 million per year. At the same time, Portland is unable to approach meeting our transportation capital improvement needs, capital improvements that are essential to a strong Portland economy, livable neighborhoods, and a safe transportation system. Portland's unfunded capital improvement needs are estimated to be $400 million over the next 20 years. Because of the demands of the maintenance side, the City of Portland budgets less than $1 million a year in Highway Trust Fund money for capital improvement projects. I find this number astonishing, especially given the size of our system. Portland is committed, and we will do whatever it takes to work with the legislature, the governor's office, and our many partners to meet the transportation needs of our citizens and the business communities. the problems we face in Portland are not that much different than those that face ODOT and other cities and counties throughout the state, as you've heard. As you know, local jurisdictions have had to resort to their own means for resolving their funding shortfalls. Cities of all sizes are faced with this. As an example, you may have heard or read about the recent efforts by the cities of Oneida and Oak Ridge to fix their basic street maintenance needs. Even though these individual efforts are one course of action for local agencies, this piecemeal approach does not resolve the statewide problem. In some respects, this approach is inequitable due to the very nature of transportation and the funding tools that are available to us. While we should maintain and possibly expand local authority for solving local transportation problems, the best solution for all of us, city and county jurisdictions as well as ODOT, is a comprehensive statewide solution. While the City of Portland is very supportive of the Governor's Connect Oregon initiative, we would also support solutions for local transportation funding that would provide a sustainable transportation system for all of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and of course I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Let's see, Bob Russell and Dee Bridges and Elkins. Come on up, Al.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association. To my immediate right is Al Elkins, who's the executive director of the Oregon Tow Truck Associations, and next to him is Dee Bridges, the executive director of the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. As we like to say, we are trucks. And we've sort of run in a pack, and we do represent the trucking industry. It's really a pleasure to be here today. We really don't know what to tell you. And the reason I say that is Chair Gilman and Representative Beyer may recall when we did a very similar presentation last session before the House Transportation Committee. And we sat up here and we said, you know, we passed OTIA 1 and interest rates were so low that there was additional funding available. So we did OTIA 2 and we really don't have great expectations. We're still in a recession and the trucking industry isn't doing very well. We don't have great expectations for this session. Well, as you all know, the result was OTIA 3. It's, as I'm told, that's the largest public works project in the history of the state of Oregon. The last session sort of felt like we went down to the convenience store for a dozen eggs and a quart of milk, and we came home with a ranch in Montana and a herd of wild horses. So our expectations for last session were more than met. I'd pass out a little map for you, which sort of depicts the OTIA 3 program. If you look at the red diamonds, and those are the state bridges, and as you know, that was the focus of OTIA 3. That was about $1.3 billion. In some areas of the state, you'll see that those little diamonds are actually a solid line. For example, the southern part of I-5 from Eugene to the California border, there's about 167 bridges that will be replaced or repaired. The blue dots are local government bridges. There's was $300 million for those. Those will begin, mostly will begin construction this year. There are also the $500 million that was for modernization projects. There were the freight mobility projects, industrial access, jobs, regional equity, statewide significance, and ODOT earmarks. So there were a number of different ones, and you can see the symbols there and see how they fall around the state. In addition to that, there was $300+ million for maintenance of local government roads and streets, totaling better than $2.4 billion. Very, very impressive, and we were certainly happy to do our part to bring OTIA 3 to you. However, when you look at this map, it's also very scary. I would say to you that we haven't even begun the construction of all of these projects. This summer, this construction season, we will begin in earnest. One of the things that concerns us the most, and one of the managers at ODOT said the other day, said, you know, as we get through the OTIA program, ODOT is going to be known as much for what it builds as for how it manages the traffic. So traffic mobility, as we go through this humongous construction phase, is a great deal of concern to us. And we have spent a lot of time working with the Department of Transportation on traffic mobility issues. And we really want to commend Bruce Warner, the director of the Department of Transportation. He has clearly placed an emphasis on traffic mobility. He has housed the Office of Traffic Mobility in his office to demonstrate what importance he places in traffic mobility, along with John Jackley and Randall Thomas, the statewide traffic mobility manager. So we think that that is a very positive thing, and we appreciate that very much. As I walk around the building, there are folks to me come up to me and say, oh, goody, what's OTIA for? And I say, wait a minute. Maybe we need a little breathing room, and I think that there are some very good reasons for that. And the current federal highway bill expired in 2003. And during the election cycle, Congress was unable to renew the six-year highway bill. We fully expect that to happen this year, and I think we're all very hopeful that that will result in increased money, particularly increased money to the state of Oregon. If there was something that I thought that you could do, that would be to emphasize to Congress that we need to get that bill out, and we need to make it bigger. I remember reading in the newspaper last week that Representative Fazio is now in a very key position as far as that bill is concerned. He's going to be one of four that it's going to be involved in the markup. So a discussion with him would be really nice. We would appreciate that. Another reason why we don't think that it's time for an OTIA 4 is when you look at the magnitude of what we have before us, we're concerned about the adequacy of resources. Are there enough construction companies to build all of this stuff? And I think that there are, but I think if we added to it, it could certainly stretch it to its limits. And although much of what we did in OTIA 3 is being constructed by the private sector, the Department of Transportation still has the responsibility to get the job done and to manage the entire program. So that's going to stretch their resources as well. Sort of a third reason is what I sort of refer to as affordability. I'm not sure that we can afford an OTIA 4 right now, and particularly from the perspective of the trucking industry. Some of you are aware, and some of you may not be, that in 1999 we passed an amendment to the Constitution. And basically what it did is it says that cars and trucks have to pay their fair share for our highway fund, which all this is coming out of the state highway fund, or at least that's how we calculate it. Some of these projects may in fact be federalized. Today, the trucking industry pays about a third of the total highway fund. In order to fund the OTIA 3 program, we had to increase the weight mile tax by about 10%, plus we increased a number of other fees. It takes a while before the trucking industry can pass those increased costs along to the shipping public. Right now, the trucking industry is also being challenged by we have to increase driver pay because of the scarcity of drivers today. And just to retain and attract new ones, we're having to dramatically increase the pay, which is a good thing. But it's certainly adding to the costs. Insurance costs are going up, particularly for health insurance. And fuel costs are astronomical. When we sat here 2 years ago, most of our members were buying fuel, diesel fuel in bulk for under $1 a gallon. Today, it's closer to $2 a gallon, although it started to creep down a little bit. But that's just been a huge increase in expenses. I was pleased when Judge Pryor said that highways are the backbone of our system. That's very true. And we're concerned that if we increase our transportation costs dramatically, that it could have an adverse impact on our economy and perhaps even act to stall the recovery. The reason I say that is that the most recent ODOT figures show that trucking currently transports about 76% of all with tons of freight in Oregon. And they're also projecting that freight is going to double between now and 2020, which is 15 short years. And they're also projecting that the trucking industry's percentage of that freight is going to go up a little bit to about 78%. So we're real concerned about any increased costs and how it might impact the economy. But I was also pleased to hear Judge Pryor say that we need to protect the existing system. We do have a bill that we hope that you'll be able to consider a little bit later in the session that is designed basically to protect the capacity on existing freight routes. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dee for his comments from the log truck industry.
Good afternoon. For the record, Dee Bridges, Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. Passed out a little fact sheet up there that doesn't have a whole lot of information on it other than just kind of introduce ourselves. OFPTA has been around for over 40 years. We represent log truckers, chip truckers, air truckers, lumber truckers. I have about 300 members who own some 700 trucks. We Bob touched on this too, but we are an active participant in all transportation issues that involve trucking. We're a member of, for example, of the Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee, which is a statutorily created organization that advises Motor Transportation Division. Member of Oregon Freight Advisory Committee, along with a lot of other people, including the cities and the counties and states, and I mean the ports and all other kind of transportation interests, including pipelines and rail and air. A couple of other committees. I got a couple of meetings this week, as a matter of fact, the Freight Mobility Meeting, and we're also involved in the. I have trouble remembering the name of this thing, whether the Technical Advisory Committee for the Bridge Program, OTA3 Bridge Program, and which is a kind of an odd name since I don't know anything about the technical aspects of building a bridge. But that and a whole bunch of other ad hoc committees. I think I have 4 meetings this week, just for example. Every time a bridge goes down, there's a culvert that's going to be replaced over on Highway 22 near Hebel that we have a meeting about, meeting scheduled for, and we'll all get together with the department and we'll work out the best solution regarding detours and hours of day that road might be closed to trucking and that sort of thing. And that happens way many more times than we would like it to happen, but it's necessary in this whole bridge production scheme or reproduction scheme. We consider ourselves partners with these guys. As Bob said, Trucks R Us, what you see in front of you, is basically the trucking lobby for the state of Oregon. And we may be little, but we're dynamic. And also with the department. I can't stress that highly enough. Bob mentioned his appreciation and admiration for Director Warner. I'd like to second that. I think he's one of the best things we have going for us. Can't think of a better person I'd rather have at the helm as we go through this rebuilding of the Oregon's Bridge program. And we're lucky to have him, and we're proud of him, and we have proud of the relationship that we have with him. We meet with him regularly and have some pretty candid discussions. Sometimes we agree, sometimes we disagree, but at least we all know where we stand. I also would like to add to that my favorite administrator in the entire state is Greg Del Ponte, who is the director of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. And I'd like to tell people that if we could clone Greg and put him in charge of all the state agencies, the state would run really well. And as I mentioned in my little sheet there, I think we're all on each other's speed dial, so we talk to each other a lot. And with that, I'll turn it over to Al.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Al Elkins. I represent the Oregon Tow Truckers Association, and I also work closely with the Car Rental Truck Leasing Association of Oregon. Today it's trucks, and Bob and Dee touched a little bit on traffic mobility. The three of us have had the pleasure of working with the committees that they've talked about. The Traffic Bridge Committee is one that I feel is probably the most important in the state, because it allows us to give input into construction areas and the flow of traffic. ODOT has provided us, our association, with a monthly update of street, road, highway, interstate construction work that we're able to fax on to our membership, and they're able to keep in their glove boxes and of their trucks. And it's very helpful in the day-to-day routine of where to go and how to get there. So, again, we appreciate their support and their working with us. That's all I have to say. The three of us be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Matt Egan.
Well, I'm going to bring a few other
something about ports.
Okay. I'm going to take my time to plug in my computer here. If we could, I've got with me today Ken Armstrong, who's on your agenda, and then Pete Williamson, who's the general manager at Port of St. Helens. They're both going to speak with you, and we're going to flip it a little. I think Ken's going to start. I'm going to go, and Pete'll bat cleanup.
It's fine.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. Ken Armstrong. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Ports Group. And what I'm going to do here this afternoon is very briefly and very generally give you a sense of Oregon's ports. And then Mr. Egan and Mr. Williamson will give you a little bit more detailed view of the Port of Portland. And then looking at the Port of St. Helens, what the other ports around the state do. So that's kind of our format. And of course, feel free to interrupt me at any time you've got a question. There are 23 public ports in the state of Oregon, and they range from the Port of Brookings Harbor down southern Kern County up to the Port of Umatilla upriver. They are all over the map, literally, in terms of geography and in terms of what they do, what their activities are. You won't find any two ports that are exactly alike, and I see, oh, thank you. You'll see, actually, if you do the counting, like the Senate committee did, there are 22 ports on this map. The one that's missing is the Port of Coquille River, which is going to be just upriver from Bandon that you'll see down there near the bottom of the map. That's one of the smallest ports that we have. Of course, Port of Portland is the largest, and they go all the way in between. We have some very distinct differences between the coastal ports and the river ports, and Pete and Pat will be able to talk to you about what the river ports are doing and how they work together. On the coast, they work together similarly, and we had the manager of the Port of Newport up before the Senate Transportation Committee. He wasn't able to be here today, although I had asked him to. What we we see on the coast are a lot of ports involved with public marinas, fishing, other natural resource industries. In the past, the wood products industry has been a huge area for the port districts. That's obviously not so much now. A lot of tourism-related activities for the coastal ports. We've seen in the ports of Oregon International Port of Coos Bay and the Port of Newport, we've seen pretty substantial declines in the shipping, but we've seen at the same time some increases in the area of industrial and commercial property development. That's one of the things that's rarely seen about Oregon's ports, and it's one of the most interesting and unique aspects of them, in my opinion, because ports are one of those unique entities. They are termed municipal corporations in statute, one of those unique entities that have the charge of job creation and economic development. There is not another entity like us. We are taxing districts. We have 5-member elected boards of commissioners, with the exception of Portland and Coos Bay, which have gubernatorial appointments for their boards. And their activities are equally varied, all again targeted towards economic development, job creation, promoting commerce and trade. Some of those activities that they are involved with include issuing bonds, levying taxes, owning and developing marina facilities, as I've mentioned, owning and developing waterfront areas, docks, wharfs, anything that is supportive of maritime commerce, shipping, barging, that whole area of activity. I mentioned owning, developing, leasing, and selling property, something that ports are very active in. The Port of St. Helens is a particular, I guess I'll say, expert amongst Oregon's ports in developing for their part of the state, developing property and encouraging businesses to come locate here for the benefit of Columbia County. So you see a real a wide variety. Now, of course, transportation is why we're here, and you'll see ports very actively involved in all aspects and modes of transportation. Ports own airports. Ports are obviously involved in shipping and maritime activities. Ports are very interested in and dependent upon having a good highway system and the railroads, of course. As a matter of fact, even the one of our ports, the Port of Tillamook Bay, owns a short line railroad. Something that was formerly owned by the state of Oregon and now is owned by the port. So very dependent upon that, and one of our highest priorities this session is Connect Oregon. We've been very active supporters of previous OTIAs, and we are now coming before this legislature looking for those non-highway multimodal freight investments that are so important in helping ports serve their areas and also serving the state of Oregon to create jobs and stimulate economic investment. With that very broad overview, I'm going to kick it over to Mr. Williamson, and I'd be happy to answer questions now or after we're all done. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to kick it over to Mr. Egan.
Either way. Just kind of keep us on our toes here. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Pat Egan, and I'm the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland. I started there just over a year ago, and I was presenting in front of a committee, I think maybe even in this room, about 3 or 4 months ago. And Representative Beyer at the time noted at the end of my presentation that I'd rapidly gone into port speak, which I think rhymes with port geek, and I want to, as much as possible, just try to make sure that I'm not going too deep into the lingo here. And so if you have any questions as I go along, please don't hesitate to stop me. Again, thank you for the opportunity. We've obviously got a great deal of infrastructure that matters, we think, to every corner of the state. Every corner of the state is served by us, and every mode of transportation is important to us in every part of the state. We have staff that provide technical assistance not only to other ports in the state, but to other railroads and other portions of the state, shippers throughout the state, in terms of getting their goods to and from market of all types, raw materials to finished products. My presentation is really just the highlights of the port operations, the infrastructure side, aviation, marine, and rail assets, and then some of our operational issues and some economic benefit data. port is a creature statute. It was started in 1891 to dredge a channel from Portland to the Pacific, and our primary mission has stayed largely the same since then, and that's to connect Portland and the Oregon region to regional, national, and international markets. And obviously we do that in all modes, as I mentioned. We have four marine terminals, four airports, and a great deal of industrial property and seven business parks. This just gives you a sense of where our property is. Obviously, you've got the Columbia River there to the north, and then the Willamette River coming in north and south. And you can see the alignment there between starting actually out at Troutdale Airport, coming into Portland International Airport, and out to the Rivergate Industrial Complex with the marine terminals. It's one heck of an alignment of transportation infrastructure. And, you know, I'm still learning a fair amount of this, but we've had, we actually had an international aviation expert in town last week, and it was his first visit to Portland, and he was just amazed at the close proximity of all these different transportation assets and the opportunity that presents to us. And I'd leave it to others to comment on it, but this really is unique internationally in terms of the alignment of all these different properties and transportation pieces of infrastructure and the opportunity it presents for us. This is the same map that has the rail overlay, and you can see UP to Chicago, Burlington Northern to Chicago, the green line there. What this really represents, along with the last slide, is that confluence of all the different modes of transportation. You've got aviation, rail, marine, and highway, obviously, I-84 and I-5 coming in. And that presents us, as I said, with a number of opportunities in terms of providing low-cost shipping and access to markets for Oregonians. I'll just go down to the second full bullet there, one of four major West Coast marine centers. Representative Hunt knows this backwards and forwards, coming from the Columbia River Channel Coalition, but there are really only four major international facilities on the West Coast of the United States. You've got the Puget Sound area with Port of Tacoma and Seattle, Port of Seattle, and then the Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area, and then L.A. Long Beach. Represents a great deal of jobs, obviously, on the West Coast or in the Portland area, and provides us with great economic opportunity. What this also allows us to do, and the arrows actually flow both ways as well, is to provide a domestic distribution gateway for the rest of the United States from the Portland area. Jobs everywhere from on-dock longshoremen to the associated businesses in the Portland area and throughout Oregon are able to get their goods into and out of markets domestically rapidly through our facilities. We're also an international distribution gateway, and these numbers, I'll jump right to something here. These numbers are a couple of years old. This is prior to us landing, so to speak. Lufthansa, Northwest Airlines, the direct flight to Japan, Mexicana, and Air China Cargo, which is, we're one of only four ports or airports in the United States that Air China Cargo serves. It's a fantastic opportunity, we think. $19 billion worth of trade through our facilities in 2002, and those numbers, I suspect, if we had the numbers for last year, would be significantly higher. It's a little bit of a cartoon, and I needed it when I first came, I guess, to really fully understand. But you can kind of see both ends of the supply chain, the logistics chain there. Port or terminals, and then trucks, obviously, added in, provide the ability for import and export of raw materials and finished products through our facilities to either be processed or sold or something to be done with them in Oregon, hopefully with an Oregon business or an Oregon consumer. And then if there is any reprocessing, going back out to international markets. And again, our statutory authority is we have the three counties, Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas in our district, but we see our transportation mission as really statewide. So we consult with, as I said, businesses and other transportation providers throughout the state. We represent a substantial economic impact for the region. I've said in an earlier testimony that we're sort of an indicator species of the economy as a whole. If our volumes are up, hopefully the economy's up. If our volumes are down, something's wrong. And a clear example here is post-September 11th, our aviation numbers, obviously on the passenger side and on the cargo side, both took a pretty significant hit. The numbers are thankfully back up above September 11th numbers now, and we're seeing that trend hopefully to just continue going forward. Obviously, we do a great deal of study, both in terms of transportation flows, our economic impact, and what we bring into the area. And these are just some of those numbers. Over 150,000 influence jobs just in the Portland Metropolitan Service area, about half and half between aviation and marine. This doesn't include numbers or studies that we've done on the impact of our industrial properties. We have about 18,000 total acres in our district, and they include customers like Freightliner, Columbia Sportswear, America Tire Factory, and businesses large and small. We have obviously a great deal of funding considerations. Top one, your committee will take up, I'm sure, as session goes forward. Obviously, highway fund is a major concern for us in terms of connectedness between our facilities and the rest of the system, and certainly appreciate the support you've given in the past to that. But as far as our infrastructure goes, it's primarily paid for and has historically primarily been paid for by our customers through whatever fees we collect on the airport side, or whatever fees are collected for marine operations. Used to be that the number was a little bit larger, but that fourth bullet there states that about 3% of our total operational budget is out of property taxes within the district. We have a marginal increment in the three-county area that gets us about $7 million annually. And just to give you a comparison, I like to trot this one out, the Port of Seattle gets about $59 million annually in property tax. So you can imagine that's a substantial operational difference between us and them in terms of their ability to capitalize projects, have a little walking around money, marketing, those kinds of things. And it also forces us to be very tight with our dollars, and I think our customers really appreciate that. Not to get too much into the numbers, I already mentioned September 11th dynamic there. Obviously very proud of our international cargo service. The tourism bill that some of you worked on last session was a major major part of maintaining going forward the international service. You can see the fifth bullet there, I think. The amount of air freight tons, that number is taking off and growing continually every year. Nationally, just to give you a sense of the types of goods that we're dealing with in air freight, about 2% of the total freight tonnage goes by air in the United States, and about 40% of the total dollar value goes by air. So that's a highly disproportionate. And when you think about the kinds of things that you're putting on an airplane, it makes some sense, but they're fairly staggering numbers. And then the last bullet there, PDX is a very concentrated employment center, both inside the gate, and I've noted about 10,000 jobs inside the gate. Those are everybody from the people who are patting you down to the people that are getting you your burger before you get on the airplane, is about 10,000. Outside the fence includes the convention facilities and the motels and restaurants and all of the various distribution facilities that have located close to the airport for good business reasons. I'll just say on general aviation, we have three other airports, Hillsboro, Troutdale, and Milano, about 300,000+ operations annually. That also provides, in addition to the community service to those individual communities, allows us to relieve some of the congestion at PDX. One thing I'll just add in here, Hillsboro, Mayor Hughes was up here earlier. We obviously operate this facility, deal a lot with the city of Hillsboro. Intel actually operates the second largest airline in the state. And when I say that, people say, well, they don't operate an airline. Well, in fact, through charters, they do, in a sense. And those flights come into and go out of Hillsboro, going down to Phoenix on a daily basis, the Bay Area, and up to the Puget Sound. A couple of slides on our marine facilities. The port operates four marine facilities now. We have had in the past more, but we operate four now, directly served by both of the major intercontinental rail lines, and five primary business lines, containers, mineral, bulks, automobiles, and grain are the primary things that we deal with, but we do have some break bulk, steel slabs, and some other things. A couple of notes here, and again, these are things that were sort of staggering to me when I was first learning them, but Port of Portland is the number one auto port on the West Coast. It's the number one grain port in the United States. And when you think about that, it makes a great deal of sense if you look at what our connections are to the interior part of the United States. We also think that it's a good indication that, for example, Toyota or some of the others that bring their autos into the Port of Portland, they believe we can operate and serve them well, and that we can get them and their products to market more rapidly than some of the other places that they can bring autos in. We annually deal with about 12 million tons of waterborne trade and serve well over 1,000 businesses annually, providing them the opportunity to connect internationally. This is a slide that does a couple of things. One, if you look at the bottom line there, it gives you the vessel transits outbound on the Columbia River on an annual basis dating back to the early 60s. You'll notice that the line has stayed about the same. So about the same number of ships are coming into and going out of the Columbia River. The upper line is a total tonnage, so it doesn't take a rocket scientist to kind of figure out ships are getting bigger, payloads or the loads are getting bigger, and again, you can kind of see the uptick in economic activity. Some of these are going into Pete's facilities. Some of them are going into Washington ports. Ultimately, a good number of them, obviously, are coming to the Port of Portland. But this, again, gives you a sense for what we're dealing with on an annual basis in terms of the freights that are, or the boats that are coming in. This slide gives you just a sense for, when I said that we serve every corner of Oregon, gives you a sense for where a lot of the goods are coming into and going out of. This is just marine containers, so it doesn't include the bulks that I've mentioned, mineral bulks, grains, and automobiles. But the numbers that you see here are the total benefit to the shipper by having Terminal 6, which is the International Container Facility, where it is. If the Port of Portland did not have that facility, you would have to get those containers up to the Puget Sound or down to the Bay Area. Those are the two other closest places. Ultimately, the bottom line there you can see is about $68 million in annual shipper savings to the region provided by Terminal 6. You can also see Multnomah, Marion, Lane, Jackson counties throughout the state. Last slide here is about just kind of give you some snippets on freight facts. Some of them I mentioned, air cargo, $5.3 billion of international air freight in value in 2003. And again, that was in a relatively down year for us, but a lot of dollars and a lot of goods and commodities are flowing through PDX. Autos, you can see over 350,000 autos annually, makes us number one on the West Coast, and also demonstrates that critical advantage that we have in distribution infrastructure. And then lastly, containers, about $3 billion in total trade, obviously, and I'd be happy to talk about this in questions. We're in a down cycle, we think, and we hope to retain some of the additional service going forward, but significant economic contribution to the region. With that, I'll close, turn it over to Pete, and thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name's Peter Williamson. I'm the Executive Director of the Port of St. Helens. I want to thank you and the co-chairs and the members of the committee for allowing me to talk with you this afternoon. I've been the Executive Director now for a little over 23 years of the Port of St. Helens, so things have changed a little bit as I've been there, and to a large degree the changes have been keyed or spurred by changes in our transportation infrastructure. Just a quick couple of facts about the port. We're the Port of Portland's next door neighbor downstream between Portland and Astoria. We have about 60 miles of riverfront, so we have the most river frontage of any port. And we too have only about 5% of our operating budget from property taxes. The balance of our budget is from enterprise activities. Our property tax revenue is limited to about $300,000 a year. You also are looking at one-sixth of the professional staff of the Port of St. Helens. We aren't a big port, and so we operate quite a bit with the private sector, putting together flexible teams of professionals and then dissolving the team once a project is done. One of the things that I wanted to impress upon you is the amount of cooperation among ports. While it appears quite often that we may be in competition, really on the river system, most of the time we're in cooperation with each other. Our sites, after having done a market study, we've found our niche, if you will. We have a differentiated market from the Port of Portland, and so most of the time we support each other through such things as channel maintenance, channel deepening activities, talking with committees such as you to make sure that the infrastructure is in place for all of us to be competitive. So with that, I'm going to get into the slides here. Again, the port mission is pretty simple. We exist under statute to help create opportunity for businesses to create jobs and create wealth for Oregonians. It's very simple. This is Port Westward. This is down near Klatskanai. It's our largest site. This site is a marine site. We're on the deep water channel. We also have barge facilities. It has rail. It has road, of course. It has two major pipelines that come onto the site and major power lines that that come off the site. You'll see from the following slides that this is a fairly active site right now. We have the bulk of it leased to Portland General Electric. However, we're working on three separate projects right now that will begin building this year that will constitute a cumulative total of approximately $600 million in private capital investment. The key to that is the infrastructure. One of the projects is the Cascade Grain Project, and I'm just going to kind of move forward in your presentation. The Cascade Grain Project is a fuel ethanol project, and it's been approved by the PUC. Only 10% of the finished product can move off of the site by truck. The balance of the finished product, or under Oregon law, has to move out by other modes. That's one of the reasons they're at Port Westward. They're set up, they will be set up to move product out by barge and also by rail. We'll be working with them to put in a rail yard. That's a private investment. It's designed so that we can add a rail loop to it in the future, so it doesn't preclude expanding the rail in the future. As a result of this private investment, the Portland and Western is going to invest approximately $8 to $9 million in the Astoria branch to upgrade the Astoria branch for the unit trains that will be bringing the corn to the facility. So just with that that one project, there will be a series of upgrades to all the various modes. Another thing that's happened as a result of this is Columbia County has been able to get $1 million Economic Development Administration grant from the federal government to do some road improvements to the road as well. And the county developed a tax increment finance district solely for the purpose of providing county road improvements to the site. So again, without the integrated improvements to the transportation system, the site would have been sitting there just like it had since the late 60s, waiting for something to happen. We don't have time today, but if you want to talk about the time I tried to show the site to a company that made plate glass, we can all have a little chuckle and talk about how successful you are with a chuck-holed county road trying to make that pitch. But anyway, transportation's the key. It's driving hundreds of millions of dollars of investment at this particular site. So we'll move on to Rainier. Here's a picture of Rainier before. That site, too, had stayed vacant just like this. The port owned half of it. The Division of State Lands owned half of it. The port went out and got a dock permit, again following our marketing plan, knowing that we needed to have a dock permit in order to maximize the value of the site. United States Gypsum came on the scene. We negotiated with the state to buy the Division of State Lands property. We sold our property, the state's property, and our dock permit to USG. USG now has four shifts working at the plant, about 140 people. They use all the modes. They bring in their ore by ship, and they, yes, can use the three extra feet, the channel deepening. They ship by truck and rail, and they're a very good employer. But again, they would not be here without the transportation infrastructure available to them. The next one is Columbia City. We bought this one from Cavenham. It had been on the market for 10 years. It was a vacant mill. In 45 days, we had it positive cash flow. Again, to a large degree because of the shipping facilities. This site has a barging facility, it has rail, and it has highway, obviously. We use some of the dredge spoils from the channel maintenance activities to build a reload facility on the north end, the downstream end of this site. This little reload yard is only 8 acres, 4 acres for a rail yard and 4 acres for a barge yard. But this little facility accumulates lumber from all the way down to Riddle, all the way up to Everett, and all the way over to Joseph from the small mills, and provides market access for our small mills. Those small mills provide market access for the small timber operators that sell their materials to the small mills. This has opened up a market in specifically San Diego, which was a different market than the Los Angeles market. They were able to stay in operation throughout the economic downturn in Los Angeles and kept these mills going. The mill in St. Helens, for example, didn't have layoffs. That was a big difference from the old days when the Los Angeles market would have a downturn. Again, channel maintenance, rail, barge, and that's how that thing worked. This is our pole yard site. This was a wood treating facility. This too has marine access, rail access, and truck access. We now have a company on there that has the permits to go out and recover all the old wood that has sunk on the lower Columbia River. And so they're pulling up all that old growth and selling it into the market, and it's marvelous wood. And they needed a facility like this where they could land the wood, they could put it onto trucks and put it onto rail cars. They now have a little mill in there that they didn't have before. And so what previously had been a wasted resource is now not only being utilized, but is providing employment. And again, because of the nature of a site like this, they're able to perform those types of activities. The next slide is another used mill. We needed space, so there was another mill that was on the market. Nobody wanted it, so the port went out and bought it. And we use all the modes here, too. We own the rail to this particular site off the branch line, and we have three different operators in here that use the rail for their materials. We have a marine contractor here that uses the water for construction purposes. And so this site now provides a home for 8 different companies that provide jobs for local people, and we use all the modes, and we're working now on doing a little bit of a rail upgrade and some other things into the site because the volumes are up and we need to make sure that we can accommodate that. The last picture is our airport, Scappoose Industrial Air Park. And this is one of the fastest growing general aviation airports in the Pacific Northwest. We have been putting in some real investment and some real time in partnership with the FAA, with which we have a very good working relationship, as well as state aviation. And In addition to it alone having the growth that it's having, we're growing it as a business park. And so we have manufacturers out there already, and we have a number of them, and a number of them are already in need of new space, which is a great problem to have. So both the port and the private sector will be building new space for these manufacturers for their growth at the airport. This also is the location that you may have heard something about for a proposed NASCAR venue for the Pacific Northwest. If you look at the right hand of your picture there, the port has an option on 435 acres. That is the site, the SCAPU site that you may hear something about that is being looked at by NASCAR. That discussion is going on. So how does that work? Well, NASCAR supports small airports like this. This airport can support NASCAR because we went out and got some federal appropriations. This is a real business airport. It's 5,100 feet of runway. We have a weather station. We have a localizer for a non-precision approach. This thing is a 24/7 business airport. We checked with TriMet just out of curiosity, how do you move this many people? And we found out that the heavy rail commuter wouldn't be booked on weekends to go down to Wilsonville. It can be used to move people to and from this venue. We've had the big tour boats get a hold of us already because we own some property on Multnomah Channel along with Columbia County that owns the road that goes right past this. And the tour boat operators are very interested in either shuttling by boat or setting up at basically as floating hotels right in the vicinity of the venue. No place like that exists in the country. And of course the road improvements, and we've looked at we've had a preliminary study done, and the road improvements, the roads can work, and so we will continue working with NASCAR and see where that discussion goes, and just stay tuned. Why is it important? It's important because it's $221 million a year in annual economic activity in the region. That's NASCAR's numbers. We didn't believe them, so we went out and got some numbers from some independent sources. NASCAR probably understated a little bit. So we can get those studies to you folks as well. This is in the mold of what everybody wants to look for when people just come to town and leave money and then go home. So it's really kind of interesting. Again, this is just a little list of information on the air park. We're going to use some of the material from channel deepening to reclaim some of the pits that are out there. We're working very closely with the Port of Portland and the other regional air parks to make sure that our air park fits in and performs its role. It unofficially can act as a reliever to Portland's system of airports, but we are not, because if we were designated as a reliever, we would have to compete with the air carrier airports for funding, and we choose not to do that. We're very successful in the niche we're in, but functionally it works as a reliever to Portland. And then you have our master plan. We won't go through that. And finally, here's just the last thoughts on the Port of St. Helens. We have our niche. It's especially for the large projects that don't fit in the metro area, that don't compete with the Port of Portland. And our work, while it's local and it's rural, can affect the entire region. And our infrastructure funding is essential for us to do our job. So I appreciate the chance to speak with you today.
Thank you. Question? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, if you talk about, as you're trying to recruit businesses, either your current tenants to expand or new potential tenants to come in and bring jobs, I mean, do you consistently hear about the challenges facing rail, channel depth, aviation service? I mean, are the infrastructure issues major hurdles, potential hurdles, if they don't get addressed, to be able to attract and grow your tenants?
Yes. Yeah, we, USG, for example, is in Rainier with one of the expectations that the channel would get deepened. They have their own fleet of ships. They have their own mines in Mexico. They're all vertically integrated, and they come in 3 feet light right now. Fortunately, our labor force is extremely efficient, so that makes up for part of it, but they're losing 3 feet on every ship.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that, a couple of thoughts. One, absolutely we do hear it across the board, and it's affecting all modes. Bob Russell talked about trucker shortage earlier today. You know, Burlington Northern is experiencing growth 3 and 4 times their projections for each of the last 2 years. It's pretty phenomenal, and it is across all modes. One thing I'd add to it, and I'll talk a little bit about marine here. You've heard recently about the congestion on the other West Coast ports. Very significant, huge issue economically. Economically, for a just-in-time economy where you're trying to get goods from point A to point B with as little warehousing and storage as is possible, and transportation logistics is a big part of that. But one thing that you didn't hear a lot about was complaints from Fred Meyer Kroger, which thankfully with Hanjin, which has stayed as our major airport or major marine carrier, they were very happy with their service. They got everything just in time, and we hope to continue to do that. But I'd add to that, we have heard a lot in the last year about major distribution facilities looking for locations on the West Coast and up and down the West Coast. OECDD is hearing the same thing. And so our ability, as I mentioned, economically to provide the transportation connections there will hopefully lead us to a lot more jobs in the near future. Thank you.
Further question?
Thank you very much. You. We have highway users.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris Adamson, and I'm here today as the president of the Oregon Highway Users Alliance. And with me is Kristen Mitchell, who is our vice president this year. You'll be getting a packet of information about the Highway Users Alliance, but in short, we're a 25-member organization, a series of associations that have come together to promote the safe and well-maintained system of Oregon's highways and roads. And we are a strong advocate of maintaining Oregon's system. We have been heavily involved in the legislative process in the last few years as individual members and the association itself in the development of OTIA. And we're proud of that package having gone through and now being implemented. The Oregon Highway Users Alliance is part of a national association, one of many around the country as a part of the American Highway Users Alliance. AHUA was founded in 1932 as the only nationwide advocate solely dedicated to safeguarding highway investments, promoting driving, improving safety and mobility, and ensuring the efficient delivery of raw materials, supplies, and finished goods that are so vital to the U.S. economy, competitiveness, and productivity. There's more information about the American Highway Users Alliance in your packet. I invite you to take a look at that. We're here this session to be your resource. There's a list of OHUA members in your packet. Please feel free at any time to call on any of us individually or to call on us collectively to provide you feedback on any of the proposals that are in front of you, connect to Oregon or any other transportation proposals that may be on your desk this session. We're here to, again, provide you information, be a sounding board, and be a supporter and an advocate of Oregon's transportation infrastructure, which is so important to the state. You can also visit our website at OregonHighways.org for additional information. Go ahead and ask for the other members of OHUA that are still in the room to stand up so you can see their faces. So with that, we're happy to take any questions that you might have.
Questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. Highway users. There's a dinner. What did I do with the agenda? February 1st. That Highway Users Association is putting on for us and the Senate, I believe, members of transportation. And not too many of us have responded yet, so it's time to talk to those individuals. With that, this meeting is adjourned. Check a lot of tests.